Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Beavers, those icons of industriousness, have been gnawing down trees, building dams, shaping the land, and creating critical habitat in North America for at least 1 million years. Once one of the continent's most ubiquitous mammals, they ranged from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from the Rio Grande to the edge of the northern tundra. Wherever there was wood and water, there were beavers. And wherever there were beavers, there were intricate natural communities that depended on their activities. Then the European fur traders arrived. This morning, we talk with writer Frances Backhouse, author of Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver, about humanity's 15,000-year relationship with beavers and the beavers' even older relationship with North American landscapes and ecosystems. Frances, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I find with great interest that this show has generated more enthusiasm on its Facebook page than any show I've done in recent times. So I'm wondering, what is it about beavers that attracts people's attention and imagination so much?
I think it's perhaps that they do things that are like humans, the way they shape the landscape. There's no other animal that has such an effect as beavers do that, you know, can rival us in their ecosystem engineering. So I think that's part of it. Also, they're just really charming animals. They're not easy to watch because they tend to be more active at nighttime. But if you do get a chance to watch them in the day, they're fascinating to watch. So, I think all of those things contribute to the interest in them.
Well, I find it interesting. I didn't really think about it a lot when I moved to Oregon a number of years ago and found out that I had moved to the Beaver State. And then the mm-hmm. city just west of Portland is called Beaverton. And there were amazing amounts of beaver references, Beaver Creek and Beaver this and Beaver that. And in your book, you sort of detail the innumerable numbers of landscape areas, towns, geographic features that have beaver in the name. So what does that say to you about the important role that beavers have played here, and something that, like when I came to Portland in early 70s, there were hardly any beaver around anymore. So let's sort of start by looking at what used to be here and then what happened after the fur traders came here.
Yes, and when I was growing up in Quebec in the 70s, there were hardly any beavers around either, and beavers were an animal that I knew about just kind of theoretically, and now they've come back so much all over the continent, and there were all these places named after beavers, as you say, that I think people just sort of took it for granted. We didn't really think about why they were named after beavers, and it was, of course, that beavers were everywhere, and they were so noticeable in their effect on the land and the waterways. And so as Europeans were crossing the continent and naming places, they were constantly aware of beavers, but at the same time, of course, the beavers were being wiped out. And so when Europeans first arrived in North America, there were an estimated 60 million, or the high end estimate is 400 million beavers, 25 million dams, beavers everywhere. And within 300 years, the population was down to less than 1% of that original number. There was just this rolling fur trade frontier that moved across the continent and wiped them out as they went and left behind all these places named after them, but no beavers.
Well, another thing that came back to my memory was when I first, a long time ago, I was given a really nice hat. It was a man's hat, and it was totally waterproof, and one day I looked inside, and it was a beaver hat, and it still didn't connect to me that what it meant. And so I wanted to talk a bit about what beaver hats were and what impact that had on the actual beavers who provided the skins for these hats.
Mm-hmm. I think when I first heard about beaver hats, I thought they were going to be kind of like a, you know, the Davy Crockett style hat where you see the fur, the tail and everything. But it wasn't like that at all. What they were doing is beaver pelts have a thick under fur and long guard hairs. And to make the beaver hats, the guard hairs were plucked, the under fur was shaved off, and then it was felted. And it makes excellent felt. You can felt all kinds of fibers, sheep's wool, rabbit fur, all kinds of fur. But the under fur of the beaver pelts have these long barbs that hook together, and so they bind together and make this very dense, strong felt, and it's also quite waterproof. So somewhere back before the 1300s, Europeans figured out that beaver pelts made really good hats, and those hats became both fashionable and very popular as a waterproof, strong hat in Europe. And so there was this demand for beavers. They have a different species of beaver in Europe, but they're very, very similar to the North American beaver. And they wiped out their beavers, pretty much. And around the time the European beaver population had disappeared, basically, Europeans arrived in North America, and lo and behold, there was a continent full of beavers. And I think of it as the first gold rush of North America. Once they realized they had this valuable resource, they started shipping them back to Europe in huge quantities, boatload after boatload of beaver pelts. And so they were supplying the European hat trade, and there was a pretty much insatiable demand. And eventually there was also the demand in North America, but originally it was this European demand for the felt for the hats. And one of the things I found out that was interesting is that even today there are still hats made from felted beaver fur, because it is still this really superior fur for hat making, but it's not as common as something like rabbit. You know, most felted hats you would see would be made out of rabbit fur.
Well, why aren't hats made as much out of beaver fur now as they used to be?
The cost. They're the really high quality, high end, expensive hats. So most people will settle for the lesser quality rabbit fur. And also, I think there's I should go back to the European hat trade and the beaver felt hats that were so popular. That these were mostly top hats, but also bowlers and every other kind of hat. As the beavers were wiped out in North America, around the same time, they also developed a different technology, a kind of a silk hat and silk top hats, and that supplanted the beaver hat. So they fell out of fashion.
Which is probably fortunate for the beaver in the long run.
Yes. Although by that point, they probably would have had to stop making the hats because there were hardly any beavers left to trap and to send the pelts for making hats. But around 1900, around the turn of the century, there was an awareness that had grown that beavers were important for something besides hats and that they were ecologically important. And there was some effort that started to be made to conserve them, to control the trapping, and gradually to bring back the populations.
Well, actually, the near extirpation of the beaver in North America kind of reminds me of the way that European settlers went after the salmon. And we'll talk a little bit about the relationship between beavers and salmon in a little bit. But I wonder if you do see analogies about, there's a certainly a very different approach that Europeans had towards the native fauna in North America than the Native Americans had. And if you see a parallel between the way that the beaver were nearly wiped out and the way that the salmon were nearly wiped out.
Yes, and we see that repeated over and over with the salmon, with the plains bison, with the passenger pigeon. There was an attitude of treating these animals as simply as commodities, and also treating them as limitless. People couldn't believe that they could be wiped out, and by the time they believed it, they were gone or down to such low numbers. No sense of stewardship, and there was the First Nations, the Native Indian approach was much more a relationship with these animals that and a respect for them for providing food and furs and all the other products that they got from them, and that respect ensured that they remained in numbers that they could keep breeding and keep providing those things.
Well, I wanted to talk before we get into the amazing life cycle and the life history of the current day beaver about some of their predecessors. Because, I mean, we've heard stories about there being beaver, I guess, the size of mountain lions or bigger than that, many 10,000 years ago or more when there were all the megafauna living in North America. So I wanted to talk a little bit about who were the beavers' predecessors and how closely related were they to these other life forms that came before them.
Yes, well, the giant beaver is, I think, holds a great, takes great hold of our imagination when we think of a beaver that was actually about the size of a small black bear. So if you think about a modern day beaver, they're about the size of a Labrador retriever, and these beavers were huge by comparison. If you measured them from kind of nose tip to tail tip, they're about as long as a smart car. So we know these beavers were back there. They actually overlap in time. They're not direct ancestors to the to our modern day beaver. They overlapped about a million years ago when the modern day beaver was coming into North America or had evolved. The giant beaver was just dying out along with a lot of the other megafauna. So people think, wow, imagine the dams they must have built or the lodges they must have built. But as far as we know, they weren't woodcutters like the modern beaver. They were they didn't eat tree food. They more ate pond weeds. They did live in ponds. And so ecologically, they were actually more like hippos than our modern day beaver.
But there was,
so they're pretty fascinating.
But there was another beaver that you mentioned.
There was a beaver. Yeah. Pardon?
Yeah, I was going to mention this other predecessor that you write about in your book, which I never heard of, that was the actually the predecessor of our modern day beaver.
Yes, so there was a small beaver up in the high Arctic where the climate was warmer than it is now. So there were actually trees up there, up on Ellesmere Island, where they found the remains of this beaver. And these are the oldest known woodcutting beavers. It's a species called Diploides, or genus called Diploides. And they were cutting trees and building dams. They believe they were building dams. They're not quite sure about that yet, the paleontologists who are studying them. But that would have been 4 million years ago that they were doing this. So there's this long, long evolutionary history between beavers creating habitat for other species, creating pond habitat and wetland habitat. So they've been keystone species in North America for at least 4 million years ago, and the joint ancestors of those two species may go back as far as 24 million years.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Frances Backhouse, who's author of Once They Were Hats in Search of the Mighty Beaver, and we're going to learn as much as we possibly can in the next half hour about the mighty beaver. So let's talk about how much the beavers have transformed landscapes. When Europeans came to the United States, they came to North America before there was the United States, and they saw this landscape that they saw that was very park-like, and they thought it was all, this was the way that God had made it. But it turns out, in fact, it was shaped both by the indigenous people who lived here and the beaver. So I wanted to talk a little bit about just how much beavers transform landscapes and how much they really shape the landscape that we came to know as North America.
Yes. Well, the way that they shaped landscape most dramatically is by all the silt that gets trapped behind their dams. And the quantities, now that we've actually studied this, it turns out the quantities of silt that and other debris that can get trapped behind the dams are significant. One study looked at a relatively small dam, so one that was built with what would be the equivalent of 5 cords of wood. It could, amass enough debris and material behind the dam, so just the silt and things that are settling out in the water when it's stilled into a pond, enough to fill 1,700 single-axle dump trucks. So that's just one small dam of the millions of dams that were all over the continent. And what happens is as dams fill up and as the beavers cut down the trees in an area, eventually it becomes unsuitable habitat, and so they move on. The dam is left in disrepair and gradually breaks down, so it's no longer holding water. And what's left is area that's very rich in silt. It's been well watered, and it becomes kind of a meadow habitat. And then gradually shrubs grow in and trees grow in, and you have a cycle that happens where, meanwhile, there's a little stream running through this, and as the trees grow back, more beavers will come and dam it again and recreate the cycle. And so this goes on with the beaver population shifting over the landscape and building up the silt, creating habitat for not only fish and birds and mammals, but changing the vegetation. And it's different in different geographies, different topographies, but everywhere that they are, they're having these kinds of huge influences in terms of hydrology and the silt deposition and really, as I say, shaping the landscapes.
So why do beavers build dams?
They build dams to create enough deep water to be able to live in their lodges through the winter when the surface of the pond is frozen. They need enough deep water that they can swim under the water, access their food caches through the winter, and then in the summer also to have waterways where they can swim around and get to the trees that they feed on and use for construction materials, because they're very vulnerable when they're on land to predators like wolves and bears and cougars, wolverines. When they're in the water, they're pretty safe, which is one of the reasons they lived everywhere in North America where there was wood or water, except for the areas where there were alligators, because that's the only aquatic predator that was a problem for them is a problem for them in North America.
So how do they build their dams?
They start by cutting down trees and getting small branches, or if there's willows, you know, they'll just cut the willow stem. So they want small diameter material. They start pushing pieces into the bottom of a creek and gradually build a kind of a network of branches, weaving them into each other, building it up, sometimes pushing stones in or other things to reinforce it, and then scooping mud off the bottom of the pond, plastering it on the upstream side to help waterproof it, and then maintaining it regularly after that to dam up any leaks.
So they must be very dexterous. I mean, they don't have opposable thumbs like raccoons.
No, but they do have dexterous little front paws. If you watch them eat, they can take like a cattail stalk and just turn it in their paws like a cob of corn as they nibble on the cattail.
Well, there's a wetland that's near my house, and I won't go walking in there all the time. And there's a fair number of beaver who live there, though I've only seen them actually a few times. But there is a tree that I noticed a few weeks ago that's almost a foot in diameter, and it's very clearly been logged by a beaver because of the shape mm-hmm. of the tooth marks on the tree. And then there's a stump, and then there's the trunk that's lying on the ground. And there's a body of water close to it, but I haven't seen any sign of a dam close by. And I'm just wondering, what did that beaver do with that tree, and why did they log it in the first place?
So is the trunk still lying there?
It's still lying there.
Yeah, they may have clipped off the branches and taken the smaller branches for food. That would be one thing to check for. And even the leaves, they might have just eaten the leaves. So they like to eat tree bark. That is their most nutritious, most important food. But they will also eat all kinds of vegetation, leaves, small herbaceous plants. They've been known to go into fields of corn and actually cut down the stalks and eat the corn. And they don't always build dams if they have deep enough water. They don't need to build a dam. Or if there's a river that's too big for them to dam, they will build their lodges on the side of the river, and what we call bank lodges. So that's why you might see beavers without actually seeing any dams. They may not need to dam in that particular place.
Well, actually, the irony about this wetland is that there's a pond in the middle of it, which was actually kind of created by the beaver, as the city was planning on turning this into a city wildlife refuge, and they were going to help kind of replicate the flow of the water between the interaction between this wetland area and the Willamette River, which is just on the other side of a railroad berm. And there was a culvert in the berm that was interacting between the wetland area and the river. And the beaver had been being trapped out for years by the railroad. But then they stopped trapping the beaver. The beaver came back and they built a dam right in the culvert. And then they argued with the Bureau of Environmental Services for several years about how that dam was actually going to function. But in the meantime, while the city was trying to get its permits, the beavers had flooded this area. So it's kind of an interesting landscape to look at and to see that it's largely, I guess, a collaboration between the city engineers and the beaver engineers. And I think that they worked out a pretty good coexistence so that now the city has what they want and the beaver are very happy there. But it's interesting to see how much, as I read your book and as I've been learning more about beaver, you can really see the influence that the beavers had on this landscape. And one of the things that the city's trying to restore is salmon habitat in this area. Mm-hmm. And there's a very strong interplay, as you write about, between salmon and beaver, which I think a lot of people don't know. But a number of years ago, I was working on a radio documentary about the Columbia River, and I got a bumper sticker from these people along the John Day River who were working on salmon restoration, and the bumper sticker said, "Beaver taught salmon how to jump." So mm-hmm. I thought that was an interesting slogan. I wanted to run that by you.
I hadn't heard that. That's great. Yes, and for quite a while, fishermen were opposed to beavers and thought the dams were blocking the migration of the fish. And the newer research shows that that's not a problem, that the salmon can negotiate most beaver dams. And that when the fry are going downstream, beaver dams are not like human-made concrete dams. Beaver dams are actually semi-permeable. So there's ways for small fish going downstream to work their way through the dams, and the large fish going upstream can jump the dams, aside from, you know, maybe in rare circumstances, a particularly large dam. But obviously, beavers and salmon had been coexisting for a long time and doing just fine. And I like that beavers taught salmon to jump.
How do beaver actually really help to rebuild salmon habitat? I mean, what would, because my understanding along the John Day River is that one of the ways that they were trying to improve the salmon habitat was reintroducing beaver to the area and then really supporting the nurturing and flourishing of beaver in that area.
I think it's because of the changing the water flow. So where you have beaver dams, you have stilled water that's perhaps better rearing habitat. I'm not familiar with that particular ecosystem, but generally what I know of salmon is that they need different kinds of water flow for different life stages. And so certainly having the beaver in there provides more diversity in the water flow. The research that I did become familiar with when I was working on the book was down at the delta where the rivers meet the ocean. And so a researcher working in Puget Sound discovered that there was a relationship between beavers living right in the intertidal shrub zone, so where you actually have saline water and where they're affected by the tide, so the tides are coming in and out. And beavers are living in this area and building very small dams on the small network of channels in the delta. And by building these little, really sort of like bathtub-sized ponds, they were providing extremely important rearing habitat for salmon there. That without the beaver ponds, they, if there's a big rainstorm, the salmon fry would just get flushed out into the delta, where they're much more vulnerable to predators. And also these little beaver ponds in the delta are overshadowed by the sweetgale shrub, and that protects them from birds like great blue herons, who would be preying on them if it wasn't there. So it's this complex and really important salmon rearing habitat that has pretty much disappeared along the Pacific coast, and yet was probably integral to salmon rearing in the past. And so now that it's been identified, which is only just a few years ago this work was done, I think there'll be more effort to try and reproduce some of this habitat for the salmon at the delta there.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Frances Backhouse, who's author of Once They Were Hats in Search of the Mighty Beaver. You talk about the resurgence of beaver in North America, and I was wondering, how have they come back after being nearly extirpated by the fur trade and by a lot of other thoughtless environmental practices or anti-environmental practices that were done in the last 150 years here?
Once there were restrictions put on the trapping, it gave them a chance to actually rebuild their populations. And so that was part of it. But in many areas, they were completely gone. So restricting trapping wasn't enough because there were no beavers there to trap anyway. So there were reintroductions done all over North America. And once the beavers were put back and allowed to reproduce in peace, they were able to rebuild their populations in most areas. And then their natural life cycle is that when they get to be about 2 years old, the young head out and go and find their own territory. So they're great colonizers if they're left in peace, and that's how they've been managing to reestablish their populations in so many areas.
Well, it seemed interesting to me to learn that this wetland near my house, which had been trapped out totally for probably 50 years or so, how quickly the beavers moved back in as soon as the railroad was prohibited from trapping the beaver. And I wonder, maybe they all came from Beaverton, I'm not sure, but I just wonder where these beaver came from that were living close enough in the city that I guess somehow the beaver population in Portland must never have been so reduced that they couldn't come back to this particular wetland.
Yes, and when they're in that young adult stage, when they're out looking for new territory, they'll travel a long way. They, especially if they've got a good river to swim in, they can go a long way down river, go up some little stream, find out if there's empty habitat there, move in. So they're pretty good colonizers if they're given the opportunity. And of course, they're coming back now to places like New York City, where you'd hardly expect to see beaver, but a few years ago, they actually moved back into the Bronx River and have reestablished themselves there.
How do they do in really
huge cities?
How do they do with really polluted places? I don't know if the Bronx River is as polluted now as it was when I lived in New York, but I mean, it was kind of notorious.
The reason they were able to come back was there was a big cleanup effort, and it's not as polluted now. So that was the thing, too. They not only were they trapped out, but yes, they were pushed out by the pollution, but it's clean enough now that they have been able to come back. Whether they'll be able to really establish a population, there's probably not enough food for them there, but enough for a couple of them to live anyway.
Well, as beaver come back to our landscapes, particularly to our cities, what kinds of issues come up between beavers and people?
Well, we tend to value our trees a lot in the cities, and so when beavers come along, and they value them too, but in a different way. We value them standing. They want to cut them down and eat the bark and build dams and lodges with them. So that's a big conflict, is the cutting down of trees. And then if they build dams that flood land that we don't want to have underwater, that's another problem. There's also been problems in some areas where in parks, people bring their dogs, the dogs jump in the ponds, chase the beavers. In Alberta, where I'm from, there was a case a few years ago of dogs harassing beavers and the beaver turning on the dogs and actually attacking a husky, so a large dog, slashing them with their very sharp teeth, and the dog died from its injuries. So to resolve all of these problems, you know, we have to really look at coexisting with them. That if we want to have beavers, and we can have beavers, we can do things like put wire around the trees that we don't want them cutting, but there still needs to be enough of a food source for them. So put perhaps planting other trees, bringing in food has been done in some places where arborists will bring tree trimmings so the beavers will have food. There can be pipes put through the dams. These are called beaver bafflers, and the pond level can be controlled through these pipes that run through the dam, and the beavers don't block them up, and so there's enough water for the beavers, but not too much water that's flooding the land that we don't want flooded. And then if there's these parks where dogs are and beavers are, you know, the dogs need to be on leashes so they're not harassing the beavers. So there's various things that can be done, and beavers are such a great addition to urban wildlife if we do work out these kind of coexistence, you know, the opportunity, just as you've talked about in your area, to go and watch beavers in towns and cities is a really wonderful opportunity.
Well, just before actually I read your book, I got an email to like a page on Facebook, which is called Beavers in the Tualatin Basin. And for listeners outside of Portland, the Tualatin Basin is the Tualatin River flows southwest of Portland and is a tributary of the Willamette River. And it flows through a lot of suburbanized areas. And it's been a very abused river, but there's been a lot of work in the last 15 years to restore it. And obviously the beavers are very busy restoring that basin as well. So if people want to check it out, I was just on the page today and they had some great pictures of beavers, and there was a beaver with a salamander hitchhiking on its back. And so this, you go to facebook.com/beavers in the basin, one word. And I found that there's a lot of people on that page are bemoaning the fact that they know this beaver. They can see the beaver dams there, and there's like descriptions of beaver dams you can go visit and walk on, and huge dams. But people aren't really seeing the beaver, except whoever it was who took those photographs. So how do people actually get to see beaver?
The beavers are mostly active at night, so the best time to see them is very early in the morning or around dusk. And the times when they're most active in the daytime would be later in the summer when they're really busy storing up food for the winter. And sometimes in the summer, if they've got families to feed, they'll be a little more active in the daytime too, if they are just busier. But dusk and dawn are the best times. And the best way to see them is to sit very quietly by the pond and just watch and wait. And often I think people don't spot beavers because they ride very low in the water. So what you're really seeing is just the top of their back, a little bit of their head. And you might not notice them if you're not sitting and taking the time, but what you might see then is this little V-shaped wake and what almost just looks like a piece of wood floating in the water, but you realize actually it's this beaver swimming in the water. And then in areas where people are around more, they often get kind of used to having people around and won't be frightened as much by the people. So I think it's, patience and luck to see them.
So are beavers more solitary? I mean, because I've seen beaver occasionally, and I only have ever seen one beaver at a time. This photograph from the beavers in the basin, actually there are four beavers in this pond swimming around. But in your experience of watching them, do you see them usually see more than one swimming at a time?
I've mostly just seen one at a time, yes. Something I've never seen, which I would love to see, is when the young kits first start coming out of the lodge and swimming around. Sometimes they'll actually hitch a ride on the back of a parent and be swimming. So that, you know, then to actually see the whole family and see them hitching a ride on the back of the parent would be great. But I haven't had that opportunity yet.
Well, in our wetland, often we see these rodents swimming around, and people think they're beavers, but in most cases they're nutria. And I'm wondering how people can distinguish a beaver from a nutria.
So I haven't seen nutria in person myself. I've seen plenty of pictures of them. You can see the tail a little bit, the beaver tail. So looking for that big flat tail would be probably the best sign to distinguish them. But if they're riding low in the water from a distance, it probably is tough to tell them apart.
Actually, one time I saw, it looked like a really big nutria. I mean, it was awfully big to be a nutria, and it had a skinnier tail. But I did some looking up after I saw it, and I saw that when beavers are juveniles, their tails aren't as characteristically flat and wide. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. So if it's a younger one, it's going to be harder to tell.
But this seems like the wake is much bigger for a beaver than for a nutria. I mean, just because they're such bigger animals.
Yeah, yeah. So it's probably a matter of after you've seen a few, you can tell the difference. But it's that first time you see them, you're not quite sure which one. Of course, if they were out on land, and that's a great way to see them. Come up on land and are, I've seen the beavers grooming. They're really quite comical as they groom themselves, just sort of pushing the water out of their fur and taking the oil from their oil glands and working it through the fur to waterproof themselves. And they're these little sort of fat little Buddhas sitting on land grooming themselves. If you saw one on land, you definitely would know it was a beaver.
Well, last summer, there's a viewing platform in this wetland, and below the platform, there's this log that goes into the pond. And I was watching, and somebody pointed out that there was a beaver there, and we were all like, oh, is it really a beaver? It's not a nutria. Looked at it, and it was definitely, not only was it a beaver, and you can tell by the tail, and it was a full-grown beaver, but it was gnawing on a stick, and it was kind of like demonstrating, this is what beavers do. So mm-hmm. It was just giving us a little case study of beaver life. So
yeah.
So I recommend to listeners, if you want to see beaver, if you don't want to go over to the west side, you can go to Oaks Bottom in southeast Portland and Selwood, and if you look really closely, there's a chance, if you go every day, maybe one day in a year, you'll see the beaver there.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking another good way to see them is if you can position yourself near the dam, because they do regularly patrol the dam to see whether they need to make any repairs, and then, you know, if there's any leaks or anything, they'll be repairing them. So that's a place that they're likely to come at all times. And you can sometimes see, too, where they have trails that they use to go on to land to their favorite feeding areas. You'll see just kind of push down vegetation as they've dragged branches back into the pond. So those would be other good places to look for them.
Well, one last thing, because one thing I really was surprised in reading your book is how large beaver dams can be, because I always thought of them as being these, you know, maybe several feet across, damming these very small streams. But you described some much larger dams in your book.
Yes. Well, the longest, currently longest known beaver dam in existence is 850 meters long, so that's about half a mile long, I think, if my math is right. But the longest known dam in history is one that was recorded that was a mile long and was wide enough that two horses could walk side by side across it. This was out on the prairies in the 1800s when the explorer and surveyor David Thompson was crossing the prairies. And because he was a surveyor, I actually trust his record of that it was a mile long.
I understand even the beaver dams out in the Tualatin River Basin are pretty big, and I think you might be able to walk on them. So I guess here in Beaverland, we have a lot of opportunities. So
yes, and they're so solidly built that even relatively small dams I've walked across because they are so solid. However, I have heard of people walking on dams and falling through the dams and getting sort of tangled up in the woods. So you've got to be careful about walking on dams, and you don't want to damage them for the beavers either.
Well, Frances, it's been great talking to you and learning a lot more about beaver. Any parting thoughts about people's relationship with beaver that you want to share?
Well, I think they can be a little bit challenging to live with, but it's definitely worth our while to coexist with them because they do so much for us. They are a keystone species providing habitat for many other species, but they also are water stewards. They're helping us with the water raising the water table, controlling water flow. They're really ecological allies for us, so it's worth our while to work out how to live with them.
I also think we could learn a few things about dam building from them and maybe learn how to make more sustainable green dams.
Yes, yes, exactly. If anyone wants to check out my Facebook page on the beavers, it's on Facebook at The Mighty Beaver, and I post regularly about various interesting things I find out about beavers.
Great. Well, I'll put a link to that on our webpage along with the beavers in the Tualatin Basin. So it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Frances Backhouse, who's author of Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk about mountains with Morris Isseman, who's author of The Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Cronus Quartet. Thanks for listening.